Posturing continues as we approach the fiscal cliff, and a new Pew Research poll shows a majority of Americans don't believe an agreement will be reached. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we talk about efforts to avoid going over that fiscal cliff and the strategies of each party to achieve its fiscal goals. We'll also look ahead to Governor Branstad's priorities in the coming legislative session, now that it seems likely he'll seek re-election. Our analysts this week, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. Politics Wednesday here on River to River starts right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As always on Wednesday, Politics Wednesday, and our guest analysts today, Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, and in our Des Moines studio, Dennis Goldford, Professor of Politics at Drake University. Tim, Dennis, welcome to both of you.
Good afternoon.
Well, let's talk about what we heard at the top of our newscast there, the continuing countdown to that fiscal cliff. 4 weeks to go until the automatic tax hikes and spending cuts of the fiscal cliff get triggered. Two sides apparently unable to resolve a central issue, whether wealthy Americans should pay more taxes than they do now. Here's a clip of President Obama's first post-election interview with Bloomberg Television.
The reason I say that is not to punish success or go after folks just because they're wealthy. It's a simple proposition that you can't raise enough revenue. And if you don't raise enough revenue through closing loopholes and deductions, then it's going to be middle-class families who make up the difference.
Tim Hagel, we heard in the news the Republicans have a proposal out there to Speaker John Boehner, a $400 billion new in tax revenues, willing to go how far to meet the president in the latest Republican proposal?
Well, the Republicans still don't want to allow tax rates to increase on the so-called rich, however you define it, or the 2% or whatever it happens to be. But what they're willing to do is to look at the notion of revenue. And that basically, in terms of the proposal, is to close loopholes and have tax reform. But as you heard in the clip, what President Obama is suggesting is that that's not enough. But even Republicans, many conservatives, are not happy with the Boehner proposal because they still see that if you're closing those loopholes, you're still increasing taxes on whoever it happens to be, and they're opposed to that as well.
How do you see it, Dennis Goldford, at this point?
We still have a Republican House where, in some cases, the question is whether the tail will wag the dog, that is, the more committed Tea Party members elected in 2010 versus the leadership, Boehner and others, Speaker Boehner. We still have a Democratic Senate, but certainly not a filibuster-proof Senate, and we've got a Democratic president. So we are where we are. Of course, we don't have the new Congress yet, but we're basically after January 20th or January 3rd for Congress. We're in the same position then as we are now, and Republicans in the House are particularly worried about primary challenges from Tea Party and others to their right, and this is a matter of the highest orthodox belief on the part of Republicans, and the whole idea of rhinos, Republicans in name only, was an attack on Republicans who were considered to be heretics, willing to work with Democrats and willing to consider such things as increasing revenue.
So, Dennis, are Republicans risking a rebellion of these conservatives if the party leaders compromise more? I mean, the level of compromise put out there has already been rejected by the president. So, very difficult position for the GOP.
Well, they're both playing chicken at the moment, I think. And Republicans are relying on what they believe to be the case in the prior 4 years with the president as somebody who can be rolled, who, if they tough it out long enough, the president will cave. And at least verbally, since the election, the president's sounded a lot more steely than he had sounded during the first couple of years. So we're in pretty much of a game of chicken at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Tim Hagel, how does Speaker Boehner deal with a more conservative wing that says the proposal that they're rejecting it? They're saying what Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell pointedly declining to endorse his proposal.
Right. Well, the problem for Boehner and the House Republicans is that they're in essentially a lose-lose position, because if they cave in on the tax increases, then they're going to have those challenges from the right, the people that are more concerned about the fiscal responsibility and keeping tax rates low. And basically the argument that they've been making all through the campaign, which is that if you raise taxes on the so-called rich, that it will hurt the economy and so slow down the recovery and so forth. On the other hand, if they don't cave in, then they're going to get blamed for anything that happens in terms of the fiscal cliff, people's taxes going up and so forth. And so the choice that they have to make right now, and this is what a number of conservative pundits are arguing, is that, well, the folks that are going to be unhappy with the House Republicans because they go over the fiscal cliff wouldn't have voted for them anyway. And so to keep the party together, they'd be better off, you know, standing firm. But, of course, there's another side to that, too, is that, well, but, you know, you may make more people angry, and especially the middle class who are paying those additional taxes. So, like I say, that they're in a tough spot either way.
Mm-hmm. We're talking, we should remember, in terms of the taxes on well, what the president's talking about, the wealthy, however we define that, $250,000 a year or somewhere and above, we're talking about 4.6 cents on the dollar. That is, you're talking about a return to the rate, the highest rate during the Clinton years. So it's not as though we're talking about some 10, 15, 20, 30% increase in taxes on those in the high income level. You're talking about an additional 4.6 cents on the dollar, going from 35 cents as the highest bracket to the return to the 39.6 cents. The Republicans, interestingly, when they passed this bill 10 years ago, left a ticking time bomb, and it was one threatening to blow up in the Democrats' face for a while. The question now is whether it blows up in the Republicans' face.
Okay. River to River listeners, so what are your observations? What are your questions as you watch this continuing standoff over the fiscal cliff? 1-866-780-9100. Are you willing to see your taxes go up if Congress fails to act in this case? River to River at iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Facebook. You can tweet us as well at IPR Talk. Once again, that number, 1-866-780-9100. Well, let's listen to a little bit more of President Obama making his case this morning in Washington, D.C. He met with business executives, encouraging them to call on lawmakers to raise the U.S. debt limit. He described how a tax increase for top earners in the country can alleviate any tax increase for the majority of Americans next year.
Any formula that says we can't increase tax rates probably only yields about $300 to $400 billion, realistically. And that's well short of the amount of revenue that's needed for a balanced package. So, what we've said instead is, let's allow higher rates to go up for the top 2%. That includes all of you, yes, but not in any way that's going to affect your spending, your lifestyles, or the economy in any significant way. Let's make sure that 98% of Americans don't see a single dime in tax increases next year. 97% of small businesses don't see a single dime in tax increases next year. And by doing that alone, we raise almost $1 trillion.
President,
without any adverse effects on the economy.
President Obama speaking earlier this morning. So how does the GOP react to rationale like that, Tim Hagel?
Well, again, the problem for the GOP is that if they give in on the tax thing, and you know, the public seems to be in favor of maybe raising those taxes on the rich, that they will get challenges. And the thing is it's not just challenges from the right, because what you'll end up seeing doing is that the Democrats will be perfectly happy to support those challengers, whether they're specifically Tea Party folks or not, as a way to undercut the current incumbent Republicans. And the idea would be not unlike what happened here in the last gubernatorial election, where the Democratic Governors Association poured a lot of money into attacks on Branstad during the primary because they thought that he was the stronger candidate, and they would have liked to have run against Vanderplatz. And so the same sort of thing would apply if the Republicans vote for tax increases in some way or form. Mm-hmm. That they would certainly be willing to criticize those incumbents, they being the Democrats, would be able to criticize those incumbents in hopes of getting a weaker challenger to maybe retake the House in the 2014 elections.
Now, the latest national survey by the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press and the Washington Post and this was conducted at the end of last week into this weekend. About 1,000 adults were polled nationwide. Pessimism about the prospects for this deficit agreement. 4 in 10, 40% expecting the president and Republicans in Congress to reach a deal by January 1st. But more than that, 49%, half, say they will not. And here's a key part. If no deal is reached, far more say congressional Republicans would be to blame, 53%. Then President Obama, 27% would blame President Obama. These opinions, by the way, virtually unchanged since early November. So, Dennis Goldford, what part does public opinion play? And, of course, Pew is not the only poll out there. But what does it play in how this moves forward? Does that tell us whose narrative is winning here?
Well, to some extent, and you certainly don't want to be in the uncomfortable position of the public blaming you for some potential catastrophe, if that's in fact what this cliff would be, and there have been some debates about that recently. But one of the things you have to remember is that when in terms of what national public opinion holds, not a single member of the House runs in the nation at large. Every member of the House runs in one of 435 districts. So, for example, in 1998, national polls showed that the public was firmly against the House vote to impeach President Clinton. And nevertheless, the Republican majority in the House indeed voted to impeach President Clinton, did not suffer any great response from that, not huge. They lost some seats, I think, in 98, but that's typical for a midterm. But the point is that they have to run in their own district. And districts have become, through gerrymander and other such means, so one party nowadays that, in fact, out of 435 seats in the House, and Tim, you may have heard of recent number in this past election, maybe no more than 25 to 45 seats out of 435 are actually competitive in any given election. So the country as a whole may be willing to blame the Republicans, but if you're a Republican member of the House, you don't have to care about the country as a whole. Your concern is what the people of your district think, and the fact that you're in office already shows that your district is pretty much on your side already.
Join our conversation. We have Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa with us. Politics Wednesday, 1-866-780-9100. We'll talk about some other things later on, but initially talking about that top political story nationwide, the approaching fiscal cliff, just 4 weeks off. Perry is in Waterloo listening to our conversation. What are your ideas, your questions as you hear this, Perry?
Hi. Well, the thing is that I don't hear anybody say, it drives me nuts. One, if you make more, you should pay more. Anything else is just plain stupid. And a low tax on profits means that I have no incentive, no motivation to reinvest that money. That's why we're seeing record high profits and record low reinvestment. There is no incentive to take that money and invest it in things that are tax deductible, like payroll, facilities, machinery and materials, the things that jobs are made out of. So the idea that a low tax or a billionaire welfare, if you want to call it that, is going to create jobs is ridiculous. It's only going to prevent jobs from being created.
And you, Perry, are you a business owner?
Yes, I am.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's get a response. Tim, do you want to tackle that?
Well, sure. To start off, the idea, there's always a difference between how much a person, you know, again, whatever the definition of rich is, how much a person pays versus what the rate that the person pays. And that's the difference that we're finding here, is that you can look at, as many have shown in various graphs that you find around from news organizations, that the rich do pay a lot more. That you know, whether it's that infamous now 47%, but it's actually something some different than that, that don't pay any federal taxes. And so clearly the rich do pay more.
Careful income taxes.
Right. That's what I'm talking about, federal income taxes. That they don't, that the rich do pay a lot more, just in terms of raw numbers, but in terms of the rate. And that's the thing that the Republicans are sticking, this point that they're stuck on, is that they want to make the rate the same, or keep the tax cut the same for everybody, as opposed to what Obama wants, is he wants a higher rate. So it's even a more, as the phrase usually goes, more progressive than it already is in terms of the tax system.
Here we have a business owner in Waterloo who can see the point, you know, you make more, you pay more.
Sure.
What part of that doesn't make sense to House Republicans?
For the House Republicans, I think it's, again, the idea that their idea of fairness is that everybody makes a lot, and that they what they see is that, well, just because somebody makes more and is successful, why should they be punished by paying more? If you know, you're paying more anyway in terms of the raw numbers, why should the rate also be something different? And that's their essential point.
Okay. Before we go to our next caller, Dennis, did you have something to add there?
Yeah, there's also a difference between the way the parties see this. I mean, for Republicans, the key to business people making investment decisions and job creation decisions is tax rates. That goes back to the whole supply-side economics that some people like Bruce Bartlett, who was a supply-sider now suggests really doesn't hold much water. But that's still Republican orthodoxy. The Democratic view is what dictates what a business person will do is demand. In other words, is there a market for the good or service that I'm selling? That's the demand side issue, and the Democrats focus more on that approach.
Okay, let's go to Bill in Bettendorf. Hi, Bill. Welcome to River to River.
Yes, good afternoon. I'd like to suggest that the transaction tax on Wall Street would be a good idea. It was talked about in Obama's first term, but Geithner and Summers talked the president out of it. It's also called the Robin Hood tax, but Wall Street got us into this mess. I think Wall Street needs to help and step up to the bat, and they need to pay. And everybody that has stocks, and especially the rich, they would pay more, and it would help balance this budget.
Mm-hmm. So Bill, you're saying that this transaction fee, by raising it, you're targeting the people who can afford to trade shares, and therefore the Robin Hood tax name. Okay, let's get a reaction to that, Tim Hagel.
Two things about that. The first is you always have to be careful about saying that the people who own stocks have to pay more, because more and more people own stocks these days as part of their retirement fund, even if they're not directly controlling it, maybe part of how their pensions are invested. And that's one of the reasons why so many states are having trouble funding their pensions now, because they were heavily invested in stocks that decreased significantly in value. The other thing is that I know it's common to blame Wall Street necessarily, and certainly there are a lot of problems in the business community. We see this on a regular basis, but individual profiteering or something of that nature isn't necessarily can't necessarily be attributed to all of the problems that we're suffering in terms of the financial meltdown, that there are a number of causes to it.
Okay, Bill, thank you for that call from Bettendorf. This comment from Monty, listening in Wisconsin to us, perhaps you can react to this, Dennis. What the Republicans should do is offer to raise the top and bottom brackets, 1-2%, and leave the middle ones alone. Pass it in the House, and then let the Senate refuse to cut the middle class tax rate.
Well, it depends upon what he means by raising the top and bottom brackets. In terms of income levels, if that's what he's speaking of, raise the income level at the lower end, below which you don't have to pay federal income taxes, and raise the income level at the higher end, meaning the people subject to the highest rates would start only at a much higher income threshold than they do now. Most Americans do think of themselves as middle class. And indeed, in fact, a lot of people say you can tax the really wealthy all you want, but that's not going to close all these holes, because the real money is in the middle class in the sense of simple numbers. That's where most people are. At the same time, I recall during the fall, I walked into a department store and a woman sort of hustled around and had seen me on local television here. And she said, "What about the working poor?" And she was in retail at a department store, and I don't know what they pay, but she clearly didn't consider herself to be middle class. And she wanted to know what anybody was going to do to help what she called the working poor. So we talk about these various designations, the wealthy, the middle class, the working poor. At the same time, of course, we have to fund the government in some way. And Americans have always been caught in the horns of a dilemma. On the one hand, Americans don't like to pay taxes. Perhaps nobody does. On the other hand, Americans like a certain level of governmental services. And the clash between the two, added by a recession or exacerbated by a recession, is this deficit.
Okay. Before we have to go to break, perhaps we can bring the debt ceiling, because that complicates this issue here. At least help us understand that the president recently telling business leaders he doesn't want Republicans in Congress to try and barter debt ceiling increase in exchange for spending cuts. And he noted what happened last year when the debt ceiling became a big problem and was an economic problem for us. So, Tim Hagel, what kind of how does that fit into this fiscal cliff debate?
Well,
the debt ceiling.
It fits in the sense that if we don't raise the debt ceiling, then we reach this credit crunch that basically we can't continue to spend, and there would be forced spending cuts, more draconian cuts, and things that would get more serious. Or what happened last time, because the negotiations went on so long and we got very close to that fiscal cliff as opposed to the current one. There seem to be a lot of cliffs around here, that our credit rating was downgraded.
And that actually cost us money, didn't it?
And that cost money in terms of higher interest rates and things like that, because you can't borrow as freely and right. So forth. But from the Republicans' point of view, that they see it as, well, this is our opportunity to try to get more fiscal responsibility. But from the Democrats' point of view, that they often don't see it as being that big of a deal. In fact, Obama would like to have the ability to raise the debt ceiling at will. But of course, the House, and it's particularly the House Republicans, but I don't even think that if the Democrats are controlling the House, that they would like to give up that particular power, because then you get a bit of a turf war between the different branches of government.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, before we go to break, your comment on how the debt ceiling ties in here or doesn't?
Well, of course, it's a threat in terms of the financial markets, on which I'm no expert at all, in terms of our credit rating. Some people argued last time that really this wasn't about future spending. This is about paying the bills we had already run up. But the idea of this debt ceiling, like a possible constitutional amendment that requires a balanced budget, in a way, all these are attempts to provide external levers on what basically Congress decides. What I mean by that is, if you don't want to spend as much, don't spend as much. But the problem is, if you want to know why government spends and doesn't spend and things it does, go home and look at the mirror. In other words, it's the public. And members of Congress find it irresistible to bring money back to the district or back to the state. And so they keep looking for these kinds of externally imposed rules or requirements that would prevent them from doing what their natural inclination would be to do.
Mm-hmm. A short answer from each of you before we go to the break on this next question. To which party is it more appealing to go off the fiscal cliff in 4 weeks' time, Dennis?
Well, there have been some thought that it's more appealing to the Democrats in the sense of their believing that the Republicans would get the blame.
Mm-hmm. You agree with that, Tim?
I think that's true, and to some extent, even the Republicans, some pundits are saying that the Republicans might as well do it, because they're going to get the blame anyway.
Okay, when we come back, we'll talk more about fiscal cliff issues. I want to touch on what I think Dennis raised in the first issue, that a noticeable difference in Obama's strategy as he comes up to the start of his second term in negotiating with the Republicans. We also want to talk about Governor Branstad's priorities in the coming legislative session, now that it seems likely he'll seek re-election. We want you to join our conversation, Politics Wednesday. Dennis Goldford, Tim Hagel with us, our analysts. We're glad to have them here. We're glad to have you next to your radio. We hope you'll chip in a comment or a question. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Back with more of River to River after a short break. This is Iowa Public Radio News. So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. It's Wednesday. That must mean it's Politics Wednesday here on the program. Indeed it is. Dennis Goldford of Drake University with us. Tim Hagel with us from the University of Iowa, dissecting the latest week in political developments. A lot of talk about the fiscal cliff. I think we can mention it. We can keep on talking about it and see how it connects with these other things. I wanted to move on back initially, before we go, to Governor Branstad's priorities, or what we think they are for the coming session, to talk about something you mentioned earlier, Dennis Goldford. Throughout his first term, some of President Obama's critics said he wasn't a tough enough negotiator, spending a lot of time on a fruitless hunt, some would say, for common ground. Now He does sound a bit tougher on issues, fiscal cliff, tax increases, spending cuts for the beginning of the year. Also throw into that the possibility of nominating that embattled UN ambassador, Susan Rice, to be the next Secretary of State. More tough talk there. Describe the evolution, Dennis Goldford, you see in President Obama's approach, the different Obama we will have or may have in this second term compared to the fresh one we had in the start of the first term.
Well, may have is the key phrase, because he's just sounded tougher when he gives an interview to somebody in the press, or I can't remember if he's had a press conference or not since the election. But he's had a tougher, more steel in the spine kind of sound. Now, if he, for example, in talking about Susan Rice, if he nominates her to be Secretary of State to replace the retiring Hillary Clinton, if he succeeds in getting her in, then that certainly helps him. If, on the other hand, Republicans are still able to block that, then that hurts him quite a bit. I mean, remember, as of, you can say officially, as of noon Eastern time, January 20th, but certainly as of the Wednesday morning following the election, Barack Obama is now a lame duck. And he has, in typical, at least in the past, in terms of political science research, he's got about 16 months or so from the inauguration in which he should be able to get some things done, if at all. But by the time we hit the summer of 2014, spring or the summer, really it's all about the midterms and in the shadow, certainly all about the next presidential election.
So remind us, why does his leverage disappear then as president?
Because people don't have to worry about, on the Republican side, running against him again. Now, Republicans were more than happy to run against him because they believed he was such a pushover. He turned out not to be. Democrats were able to turn out voters that surprised Republicans in the breadth and the extent of those numbers. But typically, if a president's reelected, there's no honeymoon because President Obama didn't have one anyway in his first term. That's typically a first-term phenomenon, but he's a known quantity. He had some increase in seats in the Senate and the House, but not enough to change the balance of power, really in either chamber. It's not filibuster-proof in the Senate. So he won a relatively strong victory, though not as strong as 2008. But legislatively, the kinds of people in a position to help him increased only modestly. So he's got to do this more on his own now. And if he succeeds, you succeed at one level, that helps you the next time. You fail doing one thing, that increases your chance of failure at the next thing.
It's interesting, as we continue to dissect and interpret the details of those election results November 6th, Mitt Romney in Iowa won on election day.
Right.
President Obama scoring a victory thanks to those urging voters to get out and cast absentee ballots those 5.5 weeks prior to the election. Romney beat Obama by 45,000 votes on November 6th. But Republicans couldn't overcome the president's hefty lead in absentee ballots. September 27th was the first day those could go. So Tim Hagel, I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on about when we look at that fact, how it's changing elections, lessons learned for the GOP since they didn't come out on the winning end when those absentee ballots were counted?
Well, this time around, Republicans knew that Democrats had usually had an advantage in terms of this old early voting approach, and they weren't able to counter it. And in fact, the Democrats did an even better job than usual. And I think part of that was because the Obama campaign knew that they were facing an enthusiasm gap when running an incumbent president as opposed to the first time around in 2008. And so they worked even harder to not only turn out their base but reach out to a lot of independent and, in our case, no party voters as well. And just I think the Republicans relied too much on the fact that they thought that they were really going to make up that difference on Election Day, and it just didn't happen.
Okay, let's shift our focus slightly to talk a little bit more about Iowa politics. Governor Terry Branstad's administration has recently proposed a removal of specific union negotiating powers in regard to discipline, layoffs, outsourcing of jobs. The administration has also proposed the freezing of wages and an increase in out-of-pocket health care costs by 20%. This fall, Branstad hosted Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker at a fundraiser in Des Moines. Walker if we remember, survived a recall challenge after championing a law that repealed most of the collective bargaining rights in Wisconsin. When asked whether he and Walker could be described as anti-union, here's what Governor Branstad had to say on this.
I think that's certainly an unfair and inappropriate characterization. He, like me and a lot of other governors, inherited a really financial mess and is making tough decisions to try to get his state on the right track. And I think the people of Wisconsin can make their judgment on their governor. And I feel confident to stand before the people of Iowa and point out what we're doing in the state of Iowa to bring more business and jobs and to increase opportunities for workers in this state.
So, River to River listeners, what do you think of the balance of power between unions and the government in Iowa? Should that balance be shifted? In which direction and why? Let me start with you, Tim Hagel. How do you see this battle, if it is a battle, between the governor and the unions developing here in Iowa?
Well, certainly Governor Branstad wants to bring more fiscal and has in the years since he took office, bring more fiscal responsibility as he sees it to the state of Iowa. And one of the problems that he and other Republicans felt was occurring was that when Governor Culver was in office, that he was giving too much leeway to the unions, too many benefits, costing too much negotiating power and all of that. And in fact, even as one of the articles indicated in the news about how Governor Branstad's negotiators, congratulated the union for their successes in the past, but basically now it's a new negotiating team, and you're going to have to work a little bit harder. The problem, though, for the Branstad administration is that having gotten the state back on a better economic footing, it means that it's harder to justify the cuts or the limitations and so forth than it would be as if we were still facing the tougher economic times.
1-866-780-9100 when you talk about the balance of power between unions and the government in Iowa. If you'd like to weigh in or ask a question, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, our email, tweet us at IPRTalk. So when we look at the Wisconsin example, how that played out, the episode with Governor Scott Walker last year, I'm wondering, Dennis Goldford, does a governor, Governor Branstad, any governor need to be, based on that, worried about going up against unions?
Well, I don't know the off the top of my head the statistics on union membership here in Iowa among the Iowa workforce. But nationally, only about 12%, I believe the latest figure is a little under 12% of the workforce overall is unionized. And a little over half of that, 6.9%, is in the private sector. And the remainder, so we're talking maybe about another 5% of workers, are in the public sector unions or government unions, AFSCME and SEIU and so forth, mostly AFSCME, American Federal, State, and County and Municipal employees. They always get a lot of bashing from Republicans, certainly, but also they're part of government. And government traditionally in America is represented by that old satirical phrase, I'm from the government and here to help, right? We tend to be suspicious of or skeptical of what government can do for us, except often in times of emergency like Hurricane Sandy or the floods in Cedar Rapids and things like that. So union power in state government seems to be part of the cost of to taxpayers of state government. And if somebody like Governor Walker in Wisconsin can make the claim that they exercise too much power and take too much or require too much in taxes from the people they supposedly serve, that has a certain political resonance to it. At least it didn't in Wisconsin. We'll find out perhaps in Iowa.
James is listening and wants to weigh in on this issue. James in Des Moines, welcome to our program.
And hi, Dennis.
Hi.
What I want to posit is that if state employees are paid too much, why does Governor Branstad have to give bonuses to his appointees like Teresa Wallert? State employees gave up a lot of stuff for the security of the position and for the pay that they receive. They can't strike, and there's some other things that they're restricted from doing as state employees. And if they're so overpaid, again, Why is it so hard to bring top-level people in from the private sector to the government sector? I think that what the private sector doesn't understand is when you're in the government providing a service, you have to provide that service no matter what your feelings are about it and no matter how much it's going to cost you to do. And okay. There's certain expertise that's gathered by income maintenance workers and the like and social workers that is just not applicable in the private sector.
James, got your point. Thank you very much for that call from Des Moines. Let's get another caller in quickly on the same topic. Dave is joining us from Norwalk. Coming up to the end of the hour, but how do you see it, Dave?
Real quick. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a government union worker. I just got notice 2 days ago that I am on call. So between now and the spring, 24/7, because I'm a government employee, I can't go anywhere that I can't get back to the city of Des Moines in 1 hour. You know, there was just Branson was just talking about a budget surplus, and he gave $280 million, I think, to some company from Egypt so they locate here, and they're not bringing many jobs. And it seems kind of like a sweetheart deal for someone. I don't know if it is for the people of Iowa. So I think it's a little disingenuous to ask me to give up what I give up. And, you know, I'm a veteran. I've worked in government for a long time, and I assure you I do not – I would love to buy a new boat for my kids and me. I can't afford that, right, because I got to pay higher health care bills. We're not making a lot of money. This is just a squeeze to retain power so he can give more benefits to his buddies and bring more companies in and get these kickbacks that he's getting.
Okay,
for
Dave.
Somebody, I don't know who. Thank you.
Dave, thank you for your call from Norwalk. So let's talk a little bit. Who wants to chip in there, Dennis or Tim? What's likely to come in this legislative session beginning in January to do with the budget, new unions, and so forth? Healthcare was also mentioned in our callers there.
Well, you know, ever since I came to Iowa in 1985 during the governor's first term and, of course, his first series of terms, the joke I used to hear about the governor was that his title shouldn't be governor. It should be Minister of Trade or Minister for Economic Development. I mean, Terry Brandt said whatever else he's interested in as governor and is someone who clearly enjoys being governor is interested in.
Is interested. Maybe you wanted to jump in there, Tim, but beforehand.
I think where Dennis was going is he's interested in promoting trade in various ways. And we've seen this with the China thing. The caller mentioned business in Egypt. And so that's one of the things that as a governor you really have to do. You have to promote your state to bring in that business. And one of the things that Terry Branstad has been successful in.
Okay. I'm back.
Okay.
Yes, Tim, that's
thank
right.
You.
Thank you for that save, Tim. Yes. No, he's been very interested in that. Now, one thing that the caller mentioned that's of interest, in the New York Times Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, there was an interesting series on when states provide economic incentives to companies to locate in the state. And Governor Branstad certainly has been someone who does that. And the series questioned really how much benefit that actually accords to the state. And one suggestion was it's better to lower taxes on business overall than to provide these incentives. And that's something that Governor Branstad clearly in terms of the commercial property tax is something he's interested in doing this session.
Let's move on quickly before our hour ends and give you another chance there to recover there, Dennis. I wanted to move on to one final topic, a national topic. We look back a year ago and Texas Governor Rick Perry, we're all talking about the fiscal cliff this year. A year ago, what was the big topic? Well, of course, Texas Governor Rick Perry argued that the U.S. needs full-time surge operations on the border, promised to be the law and order president at a Republican primary debate in September before the Iowa caucus a year ago. Dave Hollenbeck of Prescott, Arizona, pointed a finger at Perry, saying Perry made little or no effort to stop illegal immigrants coming from the country and taking U.S. jobs. It was then that Perry would utter these words that would eventually haunt him.
Every day I have Texans on that border that are doing their job. But if you say that we should not educate children who have come into our state for no other reason than they've been brought there by no fault of their own, I don't think you have a heart.
Okay, Rick Perry, that was much repeated, much analyzed, much criticized by members of his own party. I wonder, Tim Hagel, looking back at the immigration debate a year ago, reminding ourselves of that with that clip by Rick Perry, how has it evolved? How has this election changed things in terms of getting comprehensive immigration reform?
You know, I'm not sure that it has changed anything yet, but I think what it has done, especially as people look at in terms of the percentages of the Hispanic vote that went to Obama in this election as opposed to in prior elections with George W. Bush in particular, or as Rick Perry notes, what percentage he gets as running for governor of Texas, that it's something that's going to be part of the conversation. Clearly, it will be, in particular, even on the Republican side, because a number of the names that are mentioned as possible, and forgive me for saying these words, 2016 presidential election contenders, that you have folks like Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Governor Martinez of New Mexico, who are all have either Hispanic or have Hispanic connections. Jeb Bush, of course, being in Florida, but also a wife who's Hispanic. So this is going to be an issue for the Republicans, and they're going to basically need to find a way to appeal to the group of voters that they feel should be natural Republicans or at least conservatives, but haven't reached out to them in a way that's been successful thus far.
Mm-hmm. How do you think, Dennis, the election has perhaps reshaped the GOP? In terms of immigration?
Well, I don't know that it's reshaped it at all yet. I think the Republicans are engaged in this debate among themselves about what their role should be. They talk in terms of particular sort of identity politics, but some accounts of the election, looking at the numbers, suggest that Latin Americans, Hispanic Americans, voted in terms of their economic self-interest, which was not what the Republicans, or at least it's not what Mitt Romney was evidently capable of portraying. But I think the immigration issue receded somewhat because the immigration, particularly in terms of our southern border, it's the economy is a magnet. People want economic prosperity. They want jobs. And as the economy has been in difficulty, the rate of immigration, particularly illegal immigration, to the extent that it's documentable, has declined over the last couple of years. Now, as the economy recovers, that could go up and the economy, it will become much more of a salient problem.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, as we look at these numbers from the election, in 2013, when the legislatures across the country resume the state level, Republicans will have control of governor's offices and legislatures in 25 states. That's 53% of the nation's population. Democrats in control in only 15 states, 37% of the country's population. Iowa, among the 10 states in which neither party is in control, and among just four where neither party controls both chambers of the legislature. So I wonder if we can place that in any – if either of you have any way to place that in historical context, the degree to which that control or non-control at a state level plays into the bigger picture?
Well, I had seen where one of my former colleagues, Pev Squire, had noted that the amount of one-party control of the states is at a historic high, seemingly. But there's a certain swinging back and forth that goes on in terms of the parties and even within Iowa. In terms of the Iowa being split, I think that reflects our population more than anything else because we do have a fairly even split between those that are declared Democrats and Republicans, but a much larger number who declare no party. And some of those may be to the left of Democrats or to the right of the Republicans, but a lot of them are going to be in the middle, and that basically means that it's not entirely unusual for us to have this sort of a split among the not just the chambers, but even with the governor maybe controlling one office, one party controlling the governorship, and maybe the at least the other party controlling at least one of the chambers of the state legislature.
Dennis Goldford, we have about a minute left. A thought on that or
sure.
Something else?
Two quick points on the bigger picture. Number one, one of the big reasons for substantial Republican control, both of governors and state legislatures, whether entire or partial, is the 2010 midterm election. That electorate was older, whiter, more conservative, more Republican than the electorate was in either 2008 or 2012. Democrats simply didn't show up in 2010, hence many more Republican governors and state legislators. Number two, There are actually going to be 30 Republican governors. That gives Republicans a pretty good bench in terms of broader presidential politics for what will be coming up. Democrats will have only 20 governors, and it's a thinner bench. So we tend to get our presidents from governors and sometimes from vice presidents. It gives Republicans that bigger bench.
Dennis Goldford, thank you so much. Professor of politics at Drake University, thanks for joining us. Take care of that voice, Dennis.
I sure will. Thanks.
Okay. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Thank you as well for coming into our studios
Welcome.
Today. Tomorrow on this program, I'm going to be speaking with historian Bruce David Forbes of Morningside College. He's the author of the book Christmas, A Candid History. We'll find out about the history of St. Nicholas, Santa Claus, what's the difference there. It's interesting to look back at how that has evolved. Also, we'll talk to a modern-day Santa Claus of sorts, Mary Sauder. She's known as the Angel from Albia. That's tomorrow on this program. River to River, produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, Catherine Perkins, helped today in Des Moines from John Pemble. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.